Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. Before the break, we heard from Boston Globe photographer John Tlamaki, who shared his own personal memory of Jassy Correa. Jassy's kidnapping is the second such incident involving a young woman taken while leaving a downtown Boston establishment in just the past 2 months. We're going to be talking a bit more about what that means for young women in Boston and what we can all do to help prevent violence against young women. And if you'd like to join that conversation, you can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or tweet us at Radio Boston. But first, we wanted to hear from Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins, who said this at a press conference on Friday.
Jassy was not in the wrong place at the right time. She was right where every woman has every right to be, celebrating her birthday on a night out with friends.
We spoke with District Attorney Rollins earlier today, and I began by asking her why she felt that was an important point to make.
Because I think we often focus on blaming victims when we have circumstances like this. And rather than asking questions about where Jassy was or where her friends were, we need to focus our attention on men who are overwhelmingly the ones that are making these horrible decisions and being violent against women. It's not a women's issue. It's a problem that men have to take responsibility for in their own lives, in their sons' lives, and in the social lives that they have with friends and colleagues.
So the man who's allegedly responsible in this case is Lewis Coleman. He was arrested in Delaware. He lives in Rhode Island. We know that you've said at that news conference that he may be prosecuted here in Massachusetts. And, of course, we also saw a federal kidnapping charge yesterday. So how are you working things out with all the different jurisdictions in play right now?
Well, what's wonderful is we are collaborating. You know, we have an excellent commissioner here in Boston with Commissioner Gross. We have the special agent in charge of the FBI. We have excellent brothers in law enforcement in Rhode Island. Delaware has stepped up and done a wonderful job as well. And my former colleagues at the U.S. Attorney's Office are taking the lead right now. But Jassy is a girl from Dorchester. She's one of ours. We are going to fight as hard as we can to get accountability for what it is that happened to her. I am so proud when I read that complaint to see how hard she fought in the last moments of her life, kicking out that windshield and scratching this person in the face. And we believe that those are the things that are going to help us get the evidence we need to bring justice to this family.
Have you determined what, if any, charges you might bring in Suffolk County? Because it seems to be, if you read through the affidavit from the FBI that we saw yesterday, there's perhaps an ambiguous two-hour window between her abduction in Boston and her arrival at the Providence apartment, and it's not clear where she was actually killed. Is that what you're trying to sort out now?
Yeah. I mean, look, I think the federal charges that U.S. Attorney Lelling has brought with respect to interstate kidnapping resulting in death, where that occurred is irrelevant. It's that it started here. But we are going to help the U.S. attorney in any way possible. But if the facts show ultimately that Jassy was killed in Suffolk County, we're going to be speaking to the U.S. attorney about bringing a homicide charge here in Suffolk County. This is what we do in Suffolk County. We handle homicides here, unfortunately, all the time. The U.S. attorney is not as frequently bringing death charges or charges that could result in certainly the death penalty or a life without the possibility of parole. But we right now are not going to be doing a jurisdictional grab. We want to get answers to this family. We want to get Jassy back home to her family so that they can appropriately mourn her and have services for her and start this incredibly long and grueling process of trying to get answers and accountability for her death.
So I know you can't pursue the death penalty in Suffolk County. We don't have it in Massachusetts. But on the federal level, we do. Is this a death penalty case in your mind?
I was at the press conference with U.S. Attorney Lelling, and the U.S. attorney did say that this is a death penalty eligible charge, but I will leave that to him to determine what, if any, requirements would need to be met in order for that to be considered. We're just assisting in any way possible with the gathering of evidence and the sifting through all of the video evidence we have and the physical evidence and other other ways that we can try to get answers for the family.
So stepping beyond the specifics of this case, you said last week that what you don't want to see is a conversation about, you know, what women can do to be safer, you know, who they need to call or how many people they need to walk home with and that kind of thing. So I'm curious, what guidance do you give or would you give to young women in your life about how to go out and be safe but also not be victim blaming in any way?
Yeah, I mean, I would start by saying, you know, I'm going to be speaking to everyone in my life, not just young women. You know, I'm the mother of a 15-year-old daughter. I have a niece that's exactly Jassy's age that, you know, we are all taking this personally because we see people in our lives that could be this person. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to make sure that, you know, we need to take responsibility, of course, for some of our own actions. But I want to make sure I'm speaking out with respect to the men and boys I know in my life and talking to them about consent. I want to make sure I'm talking to them about respect and of women and people in general. And, you know, domestic violence and sexual assault and transphobic violence and human trafficking and other forms of gender-based violence aren't walled off from one another. They're all sort of rooted in the same outdated ways that we understand gender roles. I want to make sure my office is actively involved in sort of middle schools and high schools and talking about consent with young men overwhelmingly. And then, you know, we have a lot of work that we need to do. You know, I'm sad to say that sexual and domestic violence are really prevalent in Massachusetts, and they are gender-based crimes. And right now, for example, gender isn't one of the protected categories in our hate crime law in the state. So we have a lot of work to do with respect to women and girls, and I'm going to be an incredibly loud and shrill voice on those issues, as loud as I can, because I will not sit back silently and allow this to occur or people to blame Jassy about anything that happened to her. A man kidnapped and murdered her, and she's not going to be blamed for that.
You know, longtime Bostonians may be remembering a somewhat similar case from two decades ago that remains unsolved. 20-year-old Karina Holmer disappeared from a Boston nightclub in 1996, and her severed torso was found in a dumpster soon after. And looking back, the Boston Globe's Adrian Walker wrote that, quote, if a woman disappeared today in the heart of the city, evidence would be voluminous. There'd be text messages and surveillance video, maybe selfies with friends. And with luck, investigators could reconstruct much of her evening. So, you know, we do indeed have a lot of video to reconstruct Jassy Correa's evening, as that affidavit from the FBI showed just yesterday. We've got a suspect in custody. So those are major advances in crime solving, Rachel Rollins. But have we made similar gains in crime prevention?
Yeah, I think we have a lot of work that we need to do with respect to prevention. And what I want to say is our office is going to be looking at some of those unsolved cases for sure and seeing whether the advances that we've had with respect to, you know, DNA evidence or other advances in, you know, technology that we've had since the 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, whether we can get new leads in some of those cases. But yeah, I mean, I think we can do more work with respect to crime prevention and speaking to communities, not just women and victim blaming, but everyone about what we can do to be more vigilant and involved when we see things that are questionable and how we can hold people accountable. And in particular, men hold other men accountable if they're preying on women.
You know, one other point of comparison between the Karina Holmer case and the Jassy Correa case, you know, the Holmer case was very high profile at the time, and it involved a white victim. And I noticed, Rachel Rollins, that in your press conference, you made a point of assuring the Cape Verdean community that law enforcement is fully invested in solving the Correa case. Is that because of the way cases involving women of color have been handled in the past?
You know, in some ways, yeah, sure. I mean, I think you know, what I'm keenly aware of as a woman of color myself is I want everyone treated equally in this. And even in Jassy's press conference on Sunday, I made sure to mention a young man that was murdered the evening before in Kendrick Price. And so, you know, we sadly since I've started and taken office, or January 1st of this year, 8, 9, 10, depending on how we are categorizing them, whether they occurred here or not, deaths in Suffolk County. And each of those people, irrespective of their backgrounds or genders or race or origin or wealth, were a life that was lost, and it's tragic. And so, you know, for me, I look at this and say, I am so proud of how Boston came together, and certainly other jurisdictions as well, to try to find the person that had done this to Jassy, just like we did weeks ago with respect to a young woman that went missing, and our city went together, came together and really worked amazingly well to find her happily alive. But we have more work to do to make sure we're educating people about safety, and then also educating our men overwhelmingly about consent and violence against women and being better.
That's Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins, whose office continues to investigate the murder of Jassy Correa with possible charges coming. Rachel Rollins, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you, Callum. Take care.
So we just heard Rachel Rollins share a bit about the conversations she's having with the young women and men in her life. And we'd like to hear from you, too. How are you thinking and talking about personal safety and freedom after the kidnapping and murder of Jassy Correa? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And with me now is Radio Boston producer Paris Alston. Paris, I'm so glad you're here because you're a young woman, roughly the same age as Jassy Correa, and you can see her case through eyes that, frankly, I don't have. So how does the case resonate with you?
So, Callum, I keep thinking, this could have been me or one of my friends. I've been to Venue Nightclub on a Saturday night. It's a place to hang out, dance, and just have a good time. So this is just a very disturbing reminder that you always have to keep an eye out and take precautions, even in places where you're supposed to feel safe. And that's unfortunate because you shouldn't have to do that.
What kinds of precautions are you talking about?
So if I'm walking alone at night, I try to walk near other people. If someone's walking behind me, I try to turn around and look at them so I can see who it is and gauge how close they are. I try not to have earbuds in when I'm walking, but I might call a friend or family member if I need an added sense of security. When I go out with my friends, we have a girl code. We watch each other's drinks. We watch who may be buying those drinks. And we go to the bathroom together or in pairs. We also apply this to other women we don't know, especially if they're out alone. And we keep an eye out for them and any guys who they may be talking to, watching out for any suspicious behavior. We try to leave with who we came with, but if someone wants to leave with someone else, that's okay. We just sort of feel that person out, and we always keep each other updated throughout the night and share locations so we know where one another is. And like the Boston Globe's Janae Osterheld explained today, we always say, text me when you get home.
Right, and as Janae put it, and as we just heard Rachel Rollins say, but you shouldn't have to do all these things. So how do you balance that principle versus the practicality? I mean, is it practical to say, I shouldn't have to do this, so I'm not going to?
You know, it's tough, Callum, because you want to believe that men will change behavior so that you don't have to do that. But I think the thing about these safety measures is that all women know to do it. And it's been passed around and down through generations by the women in our lives just because we kind of, you know, unfortunately expect the worst sometimes. But it's sometimes like we're only having this conversation with one another. Think about it, Callum. How many times have you considered all the precautions that I mentioned earlier?
I mean, I think about it sometimes as a father, but my privilege as a man, quite frankly, is I've never had to think about those things for myself.
Right. And so with that, I would say that men need to be a part of this conversation. They need to educate themselves and their friends and step in when they see men mistreating women or giving them unwanted attention. But even then, I still think it's sort of idealistic that all men will get to this point. So I'm going to keep taking the same precautions that I always have.
All right. Radio Boston producer Paris Alston, stick with us. But I want to bring in another voice to the conversation. Joining us now is Gina Scaramella. She's the executive director of the Boston Area Rape Crisis Center, or BARC. Gina, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
And once again, if you want to join this conversation as well, you can give us a ring at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Gina, could you help us step back and just sort of put in context the moment that we're in right now when it comes to violence against women? I know the numbers aren't always reliable, so are we just paying closer attention or are we actually seeing an increase?
The issue of whether an incidence rate has gone up is a really difficult one to answer. Certainly, there can be increases in reporting, and definitely there can be increases in people paying attention. My guess is that this is people paying attention.
And what are you hearing from the people that you work with? Because as Rachel Rollins pointed out, this is the second similar event of an alleged kidnapping. In the first case just a couple of months ago, that person was found, so the outcome was better. But as you see coverage of this, I mean, is it a re-traumatizing event for some of the people that you work with?
Yeah, so we work directly with survivors of sexual violence and their families. So certainly any event like this, with especially such tragic and horrific circumstances, really is a re-traumatizing, re-triggering experience. So that's what we're here for, though. Our 24-hour services, our hotline, and other services are especially equipped to support people through that.
And remind us of the spectrum that we're talking about here, because, I mean, the big ones that make the headlines here, we're talking about murder, mm-hmm. kidnapping, but we're also talking about things, or at least should be talking about things, lower on the spectrum, right? Catcalls, groping, you know, unwanted advances out in a bar like that.
Right.
I mean, help us see the fuller picture mm-hmm. here.
Yeah, we use the term sexual violence explicitly because there is such a huge range of behaviors that are problematic and types of sexual violence that we're talking about when we talk about it, from incest and child sexual abuse to sexual harassment at work. So keeping that wide lens is really important because they hit up against each other and, allow people to have an explanation for why they might feel the way they feel. So, for example, we have a lot of people during the Me Too era when people were talking about sexual harassment at work, feeling really mystified at how they were feeling and didn't feel necessarily justified in their feelings. And I think when you talk with us, you can really get a sense of clarity that it's a disempowering experience, it's a vulnerable experience, and whether that happened at work or in a bar or at this level or that level, that's a common outcome.
Gina, I'm hoping that maybe you can help one of our callers. Randy is phoning in from Needham. Randy, I take it you're a concerned father. What are you wondering for Gina?
I'm a concerned,
mother, sorry.
Yeah. So my concern is that I have a 20, this is an example. I'd like to know what you or other callers will recommend. I have a 26-year-old daughter who 2 weeks ago stayed in the North End and slept at a friend's house and needed to take an Uber to the airport at 3 a.m. Mm. And she said, I'm taking an Uber to the airport at 3 a.m. And I said that I just said, be aware, make sure it's the Uber that you called, and let me know when you get to the airport. But I so many times young women will take an Uber in the middle of the night, and it's very common these days, and I just want to know if you have a response to that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, in the examples Paris was giving about the steps she takes, certainly from a personal safety perspective, there are a lot of things that you can do to sort of ensure your safety more, not 100%, but more. And those, what you recommended to your daughter about being in touch with you and following all of the Uber app or any other app safety measures is really important. So I think those are the right things to do.
Paris, I'm wondering, so our caller Randy there is talking about her daughter taking an Uber, and you and I were discussing earlier today the notion that services like Uber and Lyft, they've improved a lot of people's lives, they help us get around, but have they perhaps dulled our creepometer in a way? I mean, we've gotten more and more used to just getting into the car with a stranger. How do you see that?
Yeah, I think that's totally true. It's something I don't think twice about getting in the car with a stranger in the context of taking an Uber or Lyft. But I do think about, okay, if I'm in this car, let me sit as far away from the driver as I can. I always sit in the back right passenger seat if possible. Sometimes I opted to do the shared option just because I know other people will be in the car with me. And if I feel uncomfortable, then at least that can kind of break that tension.
So I want to bring one more voice into the conversation. We heard from Rachel Rollins and others that this shouldn't only be a talk about what women need to do to protect themselves, but also a conversation about everybody and what men should be doing as well. So I want to bring in Peter Qualiatine. He's the former director of a men's accountability program at the Seattle-based Organization for Prostitution Survivors, who's now a gender-based violence consultant, and he joins us via Skype. Peter, thanks for being here.
It's great to be here.
So, Peter, you've been running various programs for decades, working with men who engage in domestic violence. Maybe they've committed some kind of sexual assault. They've contributed to sexual exploitation. What have you learned from that kind of work about what needs to be done? What can they learn from to stop?
Well, what I've learned is that all of these forms of gender-based violence are connected. So I think it's a big mistake to silo off a sexualized murder from a sexual assault, from commercial sexual exploitation, from intimate partner violence, that these are all forms of gender-based violence and that they're rooted in gender inequality. And I think another thing to recognize is that it's not just about individuals. It's about the culture and social norms. And so if we're really going to move the needle on stopping violence against women and girls, we need to engage men to change the culture, which is a heavy lift, but I think it's the way that we're going to get there.
Peter Qualutine on the phone, not via Skype. And Peter, can you just give us an example maybe of how you go about doing what you're describing? I mean, how you teach boys, whether it's an explicit lesson or maybe it's just some more implicit setting an example of how you cultivate better social emotional skills.
Absolutely. That's key. I think that you have to start early and find multiple complementary interventions wherever you can, recognizing that an individual boy has a circle around him of folks who are involved, beginning with his parents. And I think for fathers who are in their sons' lives, recognizing that what you do matters and who you are matters. And if you're modeling the types of behavior where this young man is going to appreciate the value of being able to deal with difficult stuff that comes up in your life, having the social emotional skills to be able to navigate through things, being able to share your emotions and talk about what's going on for you. You know, all these things that are healthy forms of masculinity are going to go a long way towards countering the toxic forms of masculinity that the boy is expected to embody. And I think that as he grows through the life cycle, there need to be, again, multiple complementary interventions, middle school programs about consent and sexual harassment prevention, high school programs that deal with dating violence and commercial sexual exploitation, engaging with groups of college-age men, fraternities, sports groups, and then in the workplace, you know, recognizing that in a lot of male-dominated workplace, there's a culture of sexism and misogyny that creates the rape culture which is the context that so much violence happens in.
Once again, the number to join our conversation is 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Robert is calling from Dorchester. Go ahead, Robert.
Hi. So my concern is information about male development in the context of kidnapping and murder. And I agree with most of the points that have been made on the program so far, but I just want to be careful for us to, you know, recognize and realize that the end game isn't necessarily kidnapping and murder for men who don't who are in a position where they're trying to develop themselves well. It isn't necessarily going to that extreme and that kind of a criminal level. Do you understand what I mean?
I do, Robert. Thanks for the call. So what about that, Gina? I mean, there is a spectrum here. There is a difference between verbal harassment and murder, obviously.
Right.
But, you know, Robert's saying we need to be sure to careful to separate those two things. But do you see some overlap in the mentality there as well?
Well, he brings up, I think, a great point, because certainly you're not going to see those behaviors of murder, et cetera, in the bar. You're going to see somebody who's breaking boundaries, who's acting in ways that cause concern. And so all of the folks in that setting have a role to play in addressing it. So that's the bystander intervention sort of strategy that has really the most evidence and the most promise for change, because we can affect so many more people when we have environments that are preventative to sexual violence, where bad behavior sticks out so that we can address it and deal with it rather than being accepted, which is what often happens.
So Peter, how do you have those bystander conversations with the men that you work with? I mean, presumably they're not saying to one another, don't become a murderer, but are they talking to each other about the other stuff, the harassment in the bar that Gina was just talking about?
Well, this is one of the challenges, I think, when trying to engage men to get active in preventing domestic violence and sexual assault, is that a lot of times defensiveness comes up pretty quickly. And when people hear about sexual assault, when men specifically hear about sexual assault, many times the first reaction we hear is, well, you know, I never raped anybody, or what does this have to do with me? And I think that being able to recognize that while that may be true, that we need to look at this continuum of sexual violence, a spectrum of behaviors, starting from stuff that's pretty low level. And being able to have the courage to call somebody in, call your male friends in, call your male colleagues in, the men you work with, to have a conversation about those low-level forms of sexual objectification, dehumanization, and violence, will really go a long way towards changing the culture and changing the norms. And this is what bystander intervention is all about. And so I think that being able to sweat small stuff is important in this regard, because it's all connected to the bigger stuff.
So, Paris, I know you can't speak for all young women, but that kind of bystander intervention that Peter is talking about, can you give us some sense of what you or some other women want from your male partners? Because I think some men will listen and say, well, I don't know how assertive to be in that situation. I take my cues from her. She can stand up for herself. I don't want to be condescending either. I mean, what are you looking for?
I would like to see men call out this behavior when they see it. They know what it looks like, and they know when it's toxic, and when they can tell. Most of the time, you can tell when a woman is a little uneasy. I guess sometimes it is hard because women do tend to laugh or smile when they're a little nervous, but I think that men can do a good job of deflecting, and it doesn't always have to be brash. It doesn't have to be aggressive. It can just be as much as stepping in and saying and changing the conversation, or just trying to put a wedge between a man and a woman who he may be making uncomfortable.
And Gina, what do you hear from the people that you work with as well? I assume that they're not only talking about their own experiences, but also what they're looking for from their male partners. Mm-hmm. So as we hear from Peter and we hear from Rachel Rollins saying it's time for men to step up here as well, what are your clients looking for?
I think similar to what Paris was saying, certainly a sense that they're supported in the environment, that they're welcome in the environment, and that they have a right to be safe in the environment. And when that's not what's being seen, that is something that people, whether it's the servers, whether it's, you know, friends that are there with you, that they would take action.
All right. Gina Scaramella, Executive Director of the Boston Area Rape Crisis Center. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Peter Qualutine, former director of a men's accountability program at the Seattle-based Organization for Prostitution Services and now a gender-based violence consultant. Peter, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
And also our thanks to Radio Boston producer Paris Alston.
Thank you, Callum.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Callum Borchers. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.